Blog Talk Radio. And welcome, everybody, to the Dragon's Lair on Renegade Broadcasting, the best source for factual information on the planet. I'm not going to be doing any more three-hour shows. The last show I did, which ran almost 3 hours, got cut off at 2 hours and 7 minutes. So I may run into the archives a little bit in the future, but it'll just be for a little bit. I'm not going to read to myself for an hour like I did last weekend. So anyway, maybe we'll gradually get to all of the topics. That's why I was doing these long shows, so I could get in as many topics as possible as soon as I could. But that's just the way it goes. Tonight's topic, I'm going to start over, because I barely got into this last week, and so I'm just going to start from the very beginning. The European Volunteer Movement in World War II. The Jewish Communist Genocide of Russia and Eastern Europe. Hopefully I will finally be able to get to that one. And if there is any time left before the 2-hour mark, I may start on the an article I have called Jewish Communizing of America. If not, that'll be next week. For the record, today is July 28th, 2013, on our screwed-up Christian calendar. The sun is at 5 degrees Leo. Be sure and give a listen to all of our other hosts here on Renegade. We have Kyle on Mondays, Lou on Tuesdays, Dana on Wednesdays, Mike on Thursdays, Siegfried on Fridays, Roundtable on Saturdays, and me, of course, on Sundays. I will not monitor the chat. We have a chat at renegadebroadcasting.com. I believe we will have a stream tonight. There's a chat also, the same one, at renegadebroadcasting.chatango.com. And that same chat is also over at alternativesocial.com. I want to remind everybody of nationalprotectionism.com. Again, I have no website or blog. Probably wouldn't have a life if I did. If you want to get in touch with me, you can reach me at magus_18@geocities.com. That's magus_18@geocities.com, geocities.com. You can subscribe, just send me an email saying subscribe, or just write me. I can't guarantee I will get to all of my emails. I did not send out what I was wanting to send out. A week or so ago, I've had a lot of issues I've had to deal with, a lot of problems, and I'm not sure that the drive that I had that file on is still available to me at the moment. Long story, a lot of computer problems this week. No calls tonight. Cats on the back of the chair, dogs on the floor in the room, and just FYI, I was hoping I was going to be doing some more shows during the week, but I had too many computer issues, and I don't know how soon I'm going to get those cleared up for next week. But check, I may do some shows this week. I got a lot of work I got to get done, but I doubt it. Also, too, someone had sent me an email requesting more specific information on the Baphomet. Well, as I mentioned before, I will do a show or part of a show on the Baphomet. I'm not through culling all the information that I want to share. I've got to get it from several sources. And so I don't know just how soon I will get to that. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and, well, before I do, let me mention this. Some of the computer issues have caused me a lot of problems this week. Hopefully this browser will not crash in the middle of my show. If it does, I'm not sure what happens, but I'll make an attempt to get back into it as quick as I can and finish the show. If not, well, that's just the way it goes. So anyway, I'm going to go ahead and play another song here real quick, and then we'll get going.
Take me across the water. Well, there's 100 miles of desert lies between his heart and mine. I don't need no food, no water, no, 'cause I'm running out of time. Fights and killing, wine and women, gonna put me to my grave. Running, hiding, losing, crying, nothing left to say but my life.
Okay, I'm back. Before I get started on these articles, I've got a real brief commentary here on Nietzsche and morality. And someone had written this at The Joy of Satan, and I thought I would go ahead and share this. It's real short. Nietzsche's philosophy was that the individual has within them the God within, or the spark of the divine, and that by strict spiritual discipline, the purpose of life is the full realization of the soul nature, which is beyond the constrictions of the base ego and social constructs placed upon the individual. But in order for this process to unfold, one must cross the abyss of breaking down the samsaric self, so to speak. Part of this is the rejection of Jewish Christianity and its God, in order to liberate the God within, so that the individual may advance their own divinity. The individual can fall into the trap of nihilism and self-destruction as the effects of such journey, but the strong soul will in the end triumph and become the Übermensch, the self-realized being. Nietzsche outlines the Aryan spiritual worldview, that of the Atman, the eternal soul or God within, and its full realization to the Para-Atma, the Godhead, the Brahman. His ideal of society was one ordered upon the eternal natural way, within a class system ranked on the level of inner development of the individual in society, with the philosopher class leading at the top. An Aryan class. Who had developed themselves... Okay, I'm going to reread that. Okay, let me find the beginning. His ideal of society was one ordered upon the eternal natural way, within a class system ranked on the level of inner development of the individual in society, with the philosopher class leading at the top, an Aryan class, who had developed themselves to superhuman levels spiritually, hence an openly anti-Judaic new order. Not new world order, new order. This is not surprising, considering that Nietzsche was a student of the Aryan texts, such as the Vedas and laws of Manu and such. He openly stated he was pagan in the classical sense of the meaning, versus neo-pagan, and thus openly anti-Judaic. In his and both Hitler's statements that they are Hellenes is a deep understanding of the Aryan, as this statement is an affirmation they are followers of the Aryan religion of Greece and India, which are the same religion across the Aryan world. Greece was literally nothing but Aryan India in Europe. Okay, I thought that was worth saying there. Let me get back to this article. Let me cough real quick. The article I started last week had some things in it that I made a little brief commentary on once I'd gotten into it. But I'll go ahead and say that right now. The Waffen-SS was originally only German, and it, as time went on, it became apparent that the idea of accepting volunteers from other European countries was a good idea, and so they started doing so in 1943. And the word Waffen essentially meant militarized. The SS did not get started originally as a militarized organization. It became as such. And in the very late 20s, I think it was 1928, 29, somewhere in there. I had looked it up once. I don't remember now. When they actually decided to militarize it. And so that's where the term Waffen came into being. And from what I have read and what I have heard from talking to other people, the SS were actually like the on the front fighting. They were the leading cutting spearhead of the military assault. So anyway, I'll go ahead and get into this now. And fingers crossed on this show. We'll see if everything goes okay. This is fairly long. I may stop depending on how long it's going to take to get into it, to go to the restroom or something. We'll see. And this is written by Richard Landwehr, Landwehr. It's called The European Volunteer Movement in World War II. Oh, one more thing. When they started letting other Europeans in, they really kind of dropped the issue of religion. And so there were some Muslims who had fought in the SS, you know, and there were other various Christians, etc. And so they just kind of let them go ahead and just keep whatever religion they were practicing. You know, it's kind of like the Jewish issue, except what had already been worked out. Hitler said, you know, they were going to wait till after the war to deal with it. Well, that was pretty much the situation with Christianity. I mean, they did, you know, I've read some stuff on that to the audience here already. They did do some things on Christianity, but they were going to do it. They were going to basically come down on it, you know, a lot harder after the war. Anyway, they call themselves the Assault Generation, and they had largely been born in the years during and after World War I. coming from every nation of Europe. They had risen up against the twin hydra of communism and big capitalism and banded together under one flag for a common cause. Fully a million of them joined the German army in World War II, nearly half of them with the Waffen-SS. And it was in the Waffen-SS, the elite fighting force of Germany, where the idea of a united anti-communist Europe became fully developed. It was also in the Waffen-SS where a new society emerged from among the front fighters of 30 different nations. It was a society that had been forged in the sacrifice, sweat, and blood of the battlefield that propagated the concept of one new race, the European race, wherein language and national differences counted for little, while the culture of each nation was taken for granted as a common heritage. Many countries sent more volunteers into the Waffen-SS than they could raise for their own national armies, so something truly phenomenal was taking place. The Waffen-SS itself was something unusually special. It had started out as a small-sized personal bodyguard for Adolf Hitler, but had gradually expanded into a full-scale military force under the guidance of a number of disgruntled former army officers who saw the Waffen-SS as a chance to break out from the conservative mold that the German army had become mired in. The Waffen-SS was designed from the start to be a highly mobile assault force whose soldiers were well-versed in the art of handling modern close combat weapons. The training regimen, therefore, resembled that given to special commandos in other countries, but it predated the U.S. and British commando training by nearly a decade. The soldiers of the Waffen-SS were also the first to utilize the camouflage battle dress that was to later become so common. But in one field, that of internal personal organization, the Waffen-SS has yet to be imitated, much less surpassed. The Waffen-SS was probably the most democratic armed force in modern times. Rigid formality and class structure between officers and other ranks was strictly forbidden. An officer held down his position only because he had proven himself a better soldier than his men, not because of any rank in society, family connections, or superior academic education. In sports, one of the vital cogs in the Waffen-SS training programs, officers and men competed as equals in an atmosphere that sponsored teamwork and mutual respect and reliance. Non-German volunteers of whatever nationality were not regarded as inferiors. They were judged on their ability and performance as soldiers. The idea to actively recruit foreign nationals into the Waffen-SS came shortly after the outcome of the Polish campaign of 39, when SS units were being formed and enlarged, and it was noticed that a great many men, usually of German extraction, from foreign countries, were volunteering for service. The fact that the Waffen-SS recruitment among Germans was restricted by the Wehrmacht made these out-country volunteers all the more desirable. Since Western Europe contained many sympathizers and admirers of Germany and its National Socialist government, the SS decided to create three new regiments, Nordland, Westland, and Nordwest, for Dutch, Flemish, Danish, and Norwegian volunteers in the spring of 1940. There was at this time little in the way of a cohesive pan-European ideal to follow, but thousands of recruits turned up anyway, primarily out of disgust for the performances of their respective socialist pacifist governments. For many there was an additional incentive. In Belgium, Holland, and France, scores of populist and right-wing political figures had been arrested, incarcerated, and beaten and shot out of hand. The most famous single incident occurred in Abbeville, France, in May 1940, when French police lined up 22 leading Belgian right-wing leaders and executed them in a public park shortly before the arrival of the Germans. It was certainly a war crime of one of the first, in fact, to be committed and documented in World War II, but try to find it in a historical textbook. The establishment historians have shied away from any discussion of this event. Following this massacre, many of the followers of the victims flocked to join the new volunteer regiments of the Waffen-SS. The war with the Soviet Union, commencing in June 1941, brought a new direction to the effort to attract European volunteers in what can be called the Legionary Movement. The Legionary Movement was an attempt to attract qualified military personnel from various countries who otherwise would not have considered engagement with the German armed forces by appealing to their national pride and anti-communist convictions. The Waffen-SS undertook the task of forming legions from Germanic countries, while the Wehrmacht, or German army proper, was given responsibility over Latin and Slavic legions. The national legions proved to be a success, but for a number of reasons, primarily cost efficiency, redundancy with Waffen-SS elements, and size factor, were not worth perpetuating in the same format. The primary West European legions were as follows. Volunteer Legion Norwegian. This was an 1,150-man reinforced battalion that served with distinction on the Leningrad Front and around Lake Ilmen. It later served as the nucleus of the 23rd SS Regiment, Norge, I'm not sure how to pronounce that. On the home front, it was supported by numerous political figures and celebrities, including the famous opera singer Kristen Flagstad and Nobel Prize-winning author Knut Hamsun. Hamsun was an honorary member of the Legion and actually wore a Legion uniform. His son served with the Legion in the Waffen-SS and was decorated with the Iron Cross Second Class. Volunteer Legion Flandern. This was initially a 900-man battalion, later increased to 1,116 men, that served around Lake Ilmen under the 2nd SS Brigade and at times with the 4th SS Police Division and the Spanish Blue Division. It acquitted itself splendidly, obtaining mention in the Wehrmacht War Bulletin, among other honors. Its supreme moment came in March 1943, when it recovered a lost regimental front line sector from the Soviets in a bold attack and held on to the regional positions for a week against all odds. By the end of the engagement, the Legion Flandern had been reduced to a net strength of 45 men. Equal numbers of Flemings served with the 5th Division SS Viking and the Volunteer Regiment Nordwest. Eventually, these contingents were merged with new recruits to form the Storm Brigade, Langemark. Let me clear my throat. Volunteer Legion Nederland. There was a 26-man regiment and component of the 2nd SS Brigade on the Leningrad Front. Nederland swiftly obtained a reputation for valor and achievement. In June 1942, Legionnaires succeeded in capturing the commander of the 11th Soviet Army and 3,500 of his soldiers. One enlisted man, Sturman Gerardus Muyman, became the first Western European volunteer to receive the Knight's Cross decoration after single-handedly destroying 14 Soviet tanks in one day in February 1943. The Legion later formed the basis for the Nederland Brigade and Division. Free Corps Denmark. This was an 1,164-man reinforced battalion that served with considerable distinction in the Demyansk pocket alongside the 3rd SS Division Totenkopf. For a time, it was led by the swashbuckling Christian Frederick von Schlauberg, a Ukrainian-Danish count who met a soldier's death in the front lines. The Free Corps was authorized and fully supported by the government of Denmark. After the war, members of the Free Corps Denmark were prosecuted as traitors, with the Danish government evading responsibility by saying that the volunteers should have known that the government was merely acting under duress when it set up the Free Corps and signed the Anti-Comintern Pact. Later, the Free Corps formed the nucleus of the 24th SS Regiment, Denmark. Finnish Volunteer Battalion of the Waffen-SS. This was a 1,000-man unit that served as a component part of the Nordland Regiment of the SS Viking Division. Its greatest moment came in October 1942, when the Finns were able to seize Hill No. 711 near Malgobek in the South Caucasus in a daring frontal assault. Other Burman units had repeatedly tried to do the same but had failed. The Finns served in the Waffen-SS at the discretion of their government. which in June 1943 thought it would be more discreet to transfer the battalion from the Waffen-SS to the Finnish Army. The principal Wehrmacht legions were the following. Let me clear my throat. Hold on. And let me take a quick drink here real quick while I'm stopping. Okay. Let's see here. The French Volunteer Legion against communism. Let's see here. I think I lost my spot. The principal Wehrmacht legions were the following. Found it. The Free Volunteer Legion against communism. It served as the 638th Regiment with the 7th German Infantry Division and participated in the drive on Moscow and fought well whenever it was deployed. It was largely transferred to the Waffen-SS in 1944. Legion Wallonie, I think I'm saying that right, Wallonie. This was organized as a mountain infantry battalion. It was formed by the SS from the French-speaking Belgians, or the Walloons, or Walloons, Wallons, and was taken over by the Wehrmacht in late 1941 so as not to offend the Germanic Flemings after serving in the Waffen-SS. It fought exceptionally well in the campaign through the Caucasus Mountains alongside the SS Division Viking. It contained many former Belgian army officers and the famous political leader Leon de Grel, who exhibited a flair for death-defying heroics. It was finally retransferred back into the Waffen-SS in June 1943 at de Grel's request and was reformed as an assault brigade. The Croatian Legion. This was a regiment that fought on the southern part of the Eastern Front with considerable valor and was totally annihilated in Stalingrad. It was later replaced by 3 full-scale divisions. The Spanish Legion. This was an independent 250th Infantry Division of the Spanish Blue Division that fought with incredible heroism on the Lake Ilmen Front after it was withdrawn from the Eastern Front in August 1943 by Franco. Survivors carried on in a Spanish SS legion that fought again until the end of the war. This is Per Sorensen, Portrait of a Legionary. The 27-year-old Danish Army Lieutenant Per Sorensen, formerly adjutant of the Vyborg Battalion, was the ideal model of what the Germans were looking for when they launched the legionary movement. On the 1st of July 1941, Sorensen volunteered for service with the Free Corps Danmark, motivated by anti-communist feelings and a vague sort of national socialist attitude. In the autumn months, he attended the Waffen-SS officer school at Bad Toels, T-O-E-L-Z, and in the spring of 1942, rejoined the Free Corps as commander of the 1st Company. During the summer months, he held his company in the tough back-and-forth fighting that raged in the relief corridor of the Demyansk pocket. After several engagements, 1st Company had been reduced from over 200 men to only 40. They had to hold a long stretch of front against strong communist forces. On the afternoon of the 16th of July, 1942, Sorensen telephoned Free Corps headquarters that he didn't know whether his troops could survive another strong attack, but they would stay in position no matter what. That night, a Red Army infantry battalion attacked with tank support. The communists were soon in 1st Company's trenches. From sundown to midnight, hand-to-hand fighting raged for possession of the positions. Then suddenly it was all over, with the Russians either dead or driven out. Thanks to Sorensen's leadership, 1st Company held. In the years to come, whether in White Russia or Estonia, Latvia or Pomerania, the troops under Sorensen's command would always do the job. Before every action, the tall, slender Dane would make a personal reconnaissance of the terrain, and during the fighting, he was always at the hottest spots with the machine pistol dangling from his neck. To his soldiers, Sorensen had the uncanny habit of attracting the enemy. they passed around the phrase, wherever Sorensen is, the Russians will come. And they usually were right. For his endless solitude and patience, he received the nickname Pa Sorensen from his men. Time and time again, Sorensen provided the special qualities so vital in a leader. In January 1944, he took over an entrapped battalion near Vitino in North Russia, and literally led it to safety by staying at the point of the column on a journey through thick snow-shrouded forest. After commanding battalions and battle groups, Sorensen received command of the 24th SS Regiment Danmark, just to the east of Berlin, in April 1945. Finally, the regiment was reduced to trying to defend a streetcar station in the heart of Berlin. While climbing a telephone pole to try and survey the terrain, Sturmbannführer, or Major Sorensen, was picked up by an enemy sniper. On the next day, in the midst of the desperate last battle for the German capital, Sorensen was given a military funeral in the Ploetzensee Cemetery by Germans and Danes from the Nordland Division. With shells detonating all around, the body of Sorensen was taken to the cemetery in an armored troop carrier. Over the open grave, Sturmscharführer Sergeant Hermann gave a brief eulogy. "We are standing here by the graveside to take our last departure from a courageous Danish comrade, the foremost officer and leader of the regiment Danmark. Per Sorensen, I must, even in this hour, give the thanks of my people for you and your many Danish comrades who have stood so loyally beside us. I would like to express from my heart, may you find peace at last in our bleeding city." As Hermann spoke, the coffin, which was constructed from ammunition crates by the Nordland engineers, was lowered into the grave. Two of the Danish officers attending struggled to contain their emotions. Hermann led a last salute, and the eight-man honor guard fired three salvos over the grave. A woman flak helper tossed flowers into the grave, and each of the Danish and German soldiers attending passed by, throwing in a handful of earth. As the great city shook under rumbling artillery fire and great clouds of smoke obscured the sky, the haunting strains of "I Had a Comrade" echoed over Sorensen's grave as the funeral reached its conclusion. The tragic symbolism was complete and fitting. In the very heart of Europe, on its last battlefield, a prototypical representative of the European volunteer movement had met his end. Let me light a cigarette here and clear my throat. Hold on. The European movement takes shape. Let me get this lit. In 1943, the European volunteer movement, which had been individually developed in the legions and the Waffen-SS, was finally amalgamated and consecrated within the ranks of the Waffen-SS. The spiritual citadel of the movement now became the SS officer school at Bad Toels in Bavaria, which in 1943 established its first class, or inspection, exclusively for West European volunteers. Previously, the volunteers had received no specialized treatment, but were treated like Germans. Now all received no specialized treatment, but were treated like Germans. Now all that changed in a sense of European unity with respect for all nationalities and cultures was openly fostered. Within the next 2 years, SS Toels would produce, and that's JS Toels, would produce more than 1,000 highly motivated European officers from 12 different countries, exclusive of Germany. Bad Toels was considered the premier officer training school in World War II, and in addition to a thorough training program that featured live ammunition in most field exercises, it offered well-rounded athletic, cultural, and educational opportunities. The great opera, musical, and theatrical troops of Central Europe made frequent visits, while the athletic facilities were unsurpassed in Europe. 12 different coaches, each one either an Olympic or world-class champion in his field, supervised a vast sports program that even included golf and tennis. In the academic arena, freedom of speech was not only permitted but encouraged in the writings of such disparate souls as Marx, Hitler, Jefferson, and Churchill were openly discussed and debated. What Bad Tuels produced was literally a Renaissance man who was also a top-notch military officer. In early 1945, the staff and students were mobilized into the newly authorized 38th SS Division Nibelungen, and one of the great ironies of the war took place. A mostly German division was officered by non-German Europeans, the officer cadets, instead of the other way around. One action against the Americans in southern Bavaria. The Scandinavians, Lowlanders, and Frenchmen found themselves opposing an army whom they thought could only have existed on the Eastern Front. Like all of the Waffen-SS units to serve in the West in 1945, Nibelungen was soon victimized by numerous war crimes. Entire companies and battalions were bludgeoned and shot to death after going into U.S. captivity. To date, this grisly story has only been revealed in bits and pieces and has naturally enough been largely suppressed by the Allied side. However, it is interesting to note that some former members of the Waffen-SS consider it likely that more of their comrades were killed in American captivity than on the battlefield itself. Cigarette went out. Hold on. A European army at war. The year 1944 opened with the Flemish SS Storm Brigade, Langemarck, fighting a savage retrograde action near Zhytomyr, Zhytomyr, in southern Ukraine. Simultaneously, the Scandinavian Nordland Division and Dutch Nederland Brigade were desperately trying to stem a massive Red Army offensive in the Leningrad sector, and the European Viking Division and the Belgian Brigade, Valonian, were going into the sack of Cherkasy. The breakout from the Cherkasy pocket on the southern eastern front was a true epic of heroism, a sacrificial struggle that bound troops of different nationalities firmly together. In the post-war years, the survivors had held annual remembrance meetings so that to this day, Cherkasy remains a living symbol of the European volunteer movement. The spring of 1944 saw the three Baltic SS divisions fighting with steadfast courage on the eastern boundaries of their countries. In Lithuania, the nucleus for a new SS division began taking shape under the guidance of former Lithuanian army generals, but the country was overrun by the communists before the project could be brought to fruition. Against the Anzio beachhead in Italy, the 1st combat-ready Italian SS battalion grimly held its ground against all American breakout attempts. All over Europe, manpower was being voluntarily mobilized into the Waffen-SS to participate in what many people saw as the forthcoming decisive struggle for the freedom of the continent. Summer of 1944 saw the battle of the European SS on the Narva front in Estonia, where nationals from Germany, Denmark, Sweden, Flanders, Holland, and Estonia shared the trenches and fought shoulder to shoulder to throw the Bolsheviks back off Orphanage Hill and Grenadier Hill. Leon de Grel personally led a battalion from his Valonian division in a brilliant defensive action near Tartu on the west shore of Lake Peipus, P-E-I-P-U-S, near Brody in Ukraine. The 14th Ukrainian SS Division fought a life-or-death battle to escape from a Soviet encirclement. Only about one-fourth of the division survived the fighting, but they had acquitted themselves well. As the year went on, more and more foreign volunteer divisions were formed. Let me clear my throat. This meant that flexible leadership was needed to handle the different cultural distinctions, and surprisingly, the Waffen-SS was equal to the task. Although organized religion was kept separate from the Waffen-SS, volunteers from devout Catholic, Muslim, Greek Catholic, and Orthodox countries were given total freedom to practice their religions with their own clergy. For morale purposes, ethnic cultural activities were actively encouraged. It was quite a contrast to the way some minority groups were treated in the Allied armies at the time. Some of the foreign SS divisions composed of Russian and Muslim volunteers and had to be disbanded since the time and personnel needed to develop these units were lacking. By the autumn of 1944, the Waffen-SS European volunteer tally sheet contained the following elements: 2 Dutch brigades, 2 Belgian brigades, 1 French brigade, 1 Italian brigade, all being transformed into divisions, 2 Croat Muslim divisions, 1 Albanian Muslim division, 2 Hungarian divisions, and 2 more in the works that never panned out, 2 Scandinavian/German divisions, 2 Latvian divisions, 1 Estonian division, 2 Russian divisions, both of which would later be transferred to the Vlasov Liberation Army, 1 Ukrainian division, 1 Italian/German division, 1 Hungarian/German division, 1 Balkan/German division, 1 Serbian division, numerous ethnic brigades from the Soviet Union, and small detachments of Spaniards, Britons, Greeks, Romanians, Bulgarians, Arabs, and Indians. The foreign SS units were all suitably supplied with national badges and insignia and unit distinctions, and while there were many volunteers from such neutral countries as Ireland, Sweden, and Switzerland, they could not be openly designated as such so as to not to offend their respective governments. On the Eastern Front, the war raged with unending intensity. In White Russia, part of the French SS Storm Brigade fighting with the 18th Hungarian/German SS Division Horse Vessel sacrificed itself completely in hard defensive action, losing 2/3 of its personnel in the process. In Estonia, a regiment of Estonian soldiers who had been serving in the Finnish Army returned home to fight for their country. They were reformed into a battalion of the 20th Estonian SS Division, and in desperate combat on the Latvian frontier were virtually annihilated. With grim determination of the Latvian 15th and 19th SS Divisions fought the communists for every square foot of their homeland, while in the Carpathian Mountains, the Ukrainian Volunteer Division was reassembled. In Slovenia and Hungary, the brave Muslims of the 13th SS Division, Hanschar, performed well against both Tito's partisans and the Red Army. But in France, the 30th White Russian SS Division had virtually collapsed while in action against the Americans in French Marquis. These soldiers had only wished to fight the communists and saw no point in what they were doing in the West. This was not the case in regard to both the 29th Italian SS Division and the 34th Dutch SS Division, Landstorm, Nederland. The Italian SS troops fought both the Americans and the rear area communist partisans, and they distinguished themselves as perhaps the best troops that Italy produced during the war. Landstorm, Nederland first battled the British at Arnhem as part of a hurriedly organized self-defense brigade, but during the winter of 44-45, it was enlarged into a full-scale 12,000-man infantry division. In the spring of 1945, the almost exclusively Dutch LNSS division gave the British and Canadians fits as they tried, with little success, to advance into northwest Holland. None of the Allies could figure out why so many Dutchmen chose to join the Landstorm division, so to avoid embarrassment, the story of this unit has been largely suppressed ever since. For the Dutch volunteers, there was no motivation problem. The Allies had joined the Bolsheviks against not only their homeland, but what they perceived to be European civilization as well. Like their fellow countrymen on the Eastern Front, the men of Landstorm, Nederland, fought with a dedicated resolve. The Belgian and French SS divisions were brought up to strength in the fall of 1944 from among the many refugees that had fled to Germany, plus veterans of the war with Russia. In Holland, volunteers flocked to the Waffen SS recruiting offices like never before, and not because they had to. It didn't take a clairvoyant to see that Germany was virtually finished, but still the European volunteers rushed to join the battle. The establishment historians have never been able to understand this phenomenon. Perhaps because it involved an abstract concept alien to most of them, conscious. There was a great desire for many people who had until this point sat out the war to finally be true to themselves, to make the ultimate sacrifice out of loyalty to their beliefs, their homelands, and their fellow countrymen who had already done so much. This was Europe's moment of crisis, and many young men made the decision to leap into the crucible. It was a manifestation of spiritual honesty. The Waffen SS also managed to project a certain natural attractiveness. Little John, in his book called The Patriotic Traitors, on page 123, described the pull of the Waffen SS as follows. The runic flag evoked a heroic pagan spirit, a swaggering, defiant attitude to life, equally contemptuous of bourgeois timidity and of communist anarchy. The far-sighted Leon de Grel, who almost obtained political power in pre-war Belgium, also saw a powerful attraction and purpose in the Waffen SS. In his words, true elites are formed at the front. The young leaders are born there. The emblem of the SS shows Europe where political and social truth is to be found. We are preparing the political cadres of the post-war world in the great seminary of the front line. A good many volunteers agreed with him. The end of 1944 saw Leon de Grel's 28th SS Division, Valenian, moving into part of Belgium that had been retaken in the Ardennes offensive, where it received a hearty welcome and new recruits. But the curtain was rising on the last act on the Eastern Front, and in the weeks ahead, most of the European volunteer forces would be in action there. In Kurland, Western Latvia, three SS divisions, Lith, Nordland, 23rd Nederland, and 19th Latvian, were caught up in an unequal life or death struggle in January 1945. A few extracts from the history of the 49th Dutch SS Regiment. De Ruyter, Ruyter, gave the flavor of the action. From a series of articles titled Soldiers of Europe, SS Panzer Corps in Singrunen magazine. Let me clear my throat. After a surging back and forth struggle, the south bastion of Azoli Hill fell irretrievably to the Russians. The overpowered 1st Company SS Regiment, Ruyter, R-U-Y-T-E-R, fell back to the west. Untersturmfuhrer Schleifelder, the commander, was badly wounded and shot himself rather than fall into enemy hands. The Red Army infantry was storming forward, guided entirely by radio reports. Obersturmfuhrer Behler, B-E-H-L-E-R, directed the heavy weapons fire of his Dutch gunners at the center of the enemy onslaught. But by midday, Behler's positions were entirely surrounded by the enemy. In bloody close combat, Obersturmfuhrer Behler and a few of his men managed to break out to the west. In the same battle area, Danish Obersturmfuhrer Johannes Helmer's company from 2nd Bataan de Ruyter, R-U-Y-T-R again, was fighting for its life. Using his own initiative, Kanonier Jinsk, a private, led a small battle group to a successful breakout. Jinsk's rank insignia had been obscured by his camouflage jacket, so the men that he had been ordering about were unaware that they outranked him. During these 2 days of heavy fighting, all of the companies in the main battle line were fully extended. There was nothing to fall back on. Only 7 men could be spared to defend the whole town of Kaleti, K-A-L-E-T-I. This, the defensive struggle of SS Division Nederland, was the most heroic battle that I've ever lived through. Everyone stayed in position to the finish. The attack came right up to the barrels of our artillery pieces. The firing pits were the main battle line, but although we were weakened and dispersed, we had acquitted ourselves with honor. That was extracted from a war diary of Untersturmfuhrer Horstmann. By the end of the fighting, the SS regiment, the Reuter, with a nominal strength of 2,000 men, had been reduced to 80 combatants. The regiment was rebuilt on the run and thrown into action again on the Pomeranian front less than 2 weeks later. For the first time, De Reuter received a 3rd battalion, this being composed of Dutch and German war reporters whose jobs had become rather superfluous given recent military reversals. Remaining in Latvia was the 19th Latvian SS Division, which time and again had proved itself the mainstay of bitter defensive fighting and had received several mentions in the Wehrmacht war bulletins. The Latvian volunteers received more decorations than any other non-German group in the Waffen-SS, including the award of 13 Knight's Crosses, a good indication of their contributions on the battlefield. In Poland and Silesia, the Hungarian and Estonian SS divisions were temporarily able to stop the enemy onslaught, even though the commander of the 26th SS Division, Hungaria, Oberfuhrer Zoltan von Piski, had been killed in action at Jartschin, J-O-R-T-S-C-H-I-N. As the Eastern Front was pushed slowly westwards, bits and pieces of the 27th Flemish SS Division, Langemarck, were rushed to the Oder River line from various training camps. Here they served alongside their co-national rivals, the Walloons, in a spirit of unbridled comradeship. 1st Battalion of the 66th SS Regiment Division, Langemarck, picked up the nickname Leaping Tiger for the way its soldiers threw themselves into battle. But even more amazing was the fact that the battalion was composed mostly of teenagers from the Flemish Hitler Youth who had volunteered for service in the Waffen-SS after their country had been overrun by the Allies. If there was one drawback to service in this battalion, it was that the regimental quartermaster stubbornly saw the young troopers received a special ration of chocolate, and bonbons, S-C-H-O-K-O-L-A-D-E, and bonbons, instead of the schnapps and cigarettes passed out to the older soldiers. With a good sense of historical irony, the Eastern Front slowly bent and folded itself around the German capital city of Berlin, throwing a good many of the foreign volunteers into the battle for the city. Regiments of the 15th Latvian SS Division, battered beyond belief, had naively decided to throw in their lot with the Western Allies against the Communists, which proved to be an unfortunate decision for many of the officers who were forcibly repatriated to the death camps and made a complete circuit of Berlin, traveling in no man's land all the time until they saw a chance to make it to the American lines. The division's reconnaissance battalion went out a little too far on a scout mission and wound up being impressed into the defense of the city. To the north of Berlin, 500 survivors of the 33rd French SS Division, Charlemagne, had been decimated in the defense of Pomerania. actually volunteered to go to the defense of the German capital, even though the divisional commander had absolved them from any more service obligations. In the week of the epic battle that followed, these Frenchmen constituted the corps of defense in the city's center, displaying courage and fortitude on a scale seldom seen. When the fighting was over, only a few dozen would still be alive, and four of their number would be decorated with Knight's Crosses. One could call their mission a Beaugest, Beaugeste, but the French soldiers saw it as a moral obligation, another abstract concept the establishment scholars choke on. The following is a description of these soldiers from the article Defeat in the Ruins, France's Last Battle for Europe, by Gustav Jürgens, out of Singerinnen in June of 1980. It says, by this time, the warriors of the Charlemagne division didn't even look like human beings anymore. Their eyes were burning and their faces skull-like and covered in dirt and mortar dust. Supplies only came in negligible amounts, the most telling being the lack of water. The young SS men moved like robots through the hell of Berlin. The future was the farthest thing from anyone's mind. The only motivating idea that burned in their consciousness and kept them from collapsing was their flaming desire to come to grips with the Bolsheviks. They had to throw hand grenades, destroy tanks, and hold out against the Reds. That was their only reason for living and for dying. The SS divisions Wallonian, Nederland, and Nordland, after spearheading the last successful offensive on the Vistula sector to relieve the trapped garrisons in Arneswald, had been driven inexorably westward. Nederland was split into two segments, one being trapped and destroyed in the Halbe Pocket, H-A-L-B-E, to the south of Berlin, and the other retreating to the north of Berlin. Much of the Nordland division, including the staff elements, wound up in Berlin itself. At Prenzlau, due north of Berlin, the Flemish Langemark division, led by the Leaping Tigers of its Hitler Youth battalions, made the last relief against the communist encirclement on April 25, 1945. In violent, savage fighting, Langemark was burnt to a cinder, along with the Wallonian division and parts of Charlemagne and Nordland. The survivors were forced to fall back towards the Elbe River. In Silesia, the 20th Estonian SS Division was surrounded and forced to surrender to the Soviets, beginning what for most would be a long final journey to the gulags. One, the Austrian frontier, the Ukrainian, Muslim, and Cossack SS formations fought with skill and valor before retreating to the west. Most of the Muslims and Cossacks would later be forcibly repatriated to their deaths at the hands of the Yugoslav and Soviet communists. The Ukrainians escaped this real Holocaust by posing as pre-war Polish citizens. Let me clear my...
Do the work. Okay. My headset died for whatever reason. I'm not sure. So it died, came back on. It wouldn't stay on. I played, played a song. I don't know at what point that it quit. I could have been reading for a while there and didn't even know it. And so I went ahead and called in with my landline. And so anyway, I don't know what the problem is, but what I'm going to do is I'm just going to go ahead and start the other article, and I'll have to finish that other one another time. For whatever reason, something doesn't want me to get the rest of that article out, but that's the way it goes. So anyway, let me move on. And I'll figure out where I left off at a future point and come back to it. And next time I have a problem with my computer, I'll probably just use the phone line instead of trying to Skype. Hopefully it's not my actual headset that has gone out, but maybe it is. I have backups if it was the problem. So anyway, let me take this headset off and get the other one off from around my neck real quick and get this one back on. Hold on. Okay. This is called the Jewish Communist Genocide of Russia and East Europe. Every day we have our senses assaulted by the Jewish media lies machines. Media lie machines. Favorite fable of the fictional Holocaust of 6 million poor Jews by the Germans. Despite the fact such lies have already been exposed by numerous experts from across the world, and even during the landmark trial of Zundel, which did not stop him from being put in prison for 5 years for telling the truth, the Jews keep up the wailing of their lies as they are the race of the big lie. At this point, as their holy hoax tales unravel daily, they are left only with the state-backed terrorism aimed at those who tell the truth on the subject in a desperate bid to use fear to silence those brave souls who speak out. The truth does not fear investigation. Exposing the biggest lie of the 20th century, look up Ernst Zundel. In this article that I'm going to read here, the Jewish-led slaughter cost of the Gentile people of Eastern Europe will be examined. The Jews, literally, in their drive of their Talmudic psyche, systematically murdered over 60 million innocent Gentiles, a whole nation genocided from the top down. And this is a quote from Jew Trotsky from 1917. We must turn Russia into a desert populated by white Negroes upon whom we shall impose a tyranny such as the most terrible Eastern despots never dreamt of. The only difference that this will be a left-wing tyranny, not a right-wing tyranny. It will be a red tyranny and not a white one. We mean the word red literally because we shall shed such floods of blood as it will make all the human losses suffered in the capitalist wars pale by comparison. The biggest bankers across the ocean will work in the closest possible contact with us. If we win the revolution, we shall establish the power of Zionism upon the wreckage of the revolution's funeral, and we shall become a power before which the whole world will sink to its knees. We shall show what real power is by means of terror and bloodbaths. We shall reduce the Russian intelligentsia to a state of complete stupefaction and idiocy to an animal existence. That was from the memoirs of Aaron Simonovich, quoted in The Nature of Zionism by Vladimir Stepin, Moscow, 1993, and translated from Russian and English by Clive Lindhurst. Very telling, wasn't it? The major events that led to the communist revolution in the East was the First War. This war was instigated by Jewry for the purpose of toppling the remaining remnants of the old Gentile political, social, and economic power structures, and creating a chaotic situation that would make the Western world ripe to be seized upon by Jewry and lead into its destruction and enslavement via a global communist takeover. In essence, the Hegelian dialectic of problem, reaction, solution. This war alone killed over 16 million people. The official trigger event was the murder of Ferdinand and his wife. The Jewish revolutionary Gavrilo Princip, shown being seized by police moments after mortally wounding Archduke Ferdinand and his wife. The assassination of Catholic monarch Crown Prince Franz Ferdinand, heir to the Austrian throne, was carried out by the Jewish assassin Gavrilo Princip using a Browning pistol on June 28, 1914. The Zionist newspaper Peiwash Vortel wrote on January 13, 1919, that the international Jewry believed it necessary to force Europe into the war so that a new Jewish era could begin throughout the world. Archduke Ferdinand was assassinated by Gavrilo Princip at Sarajevo, Austria, and demanded an apology from Serbia. Serbia apologized, but Austria inexplicably declared war anyway. Max Warburg, Jewish advisor to the Kaiser, who had also helped fund the Jewish Bolshevik Revolution, also advised the Kaiser to go into World War I so Zionists could push for an Israeli state. Both Warburg and Schiff were Rothschild agents. Warburg also arranged for Lenin to be transported through Germany to Russia in a sealed train to lead the conspirators to their Bolshevik triumph. Three Jewish advisors to Kaiser Wilhelm, Chancellor Bethmann Hollweg, Max Warburg, and Albert Bellin, then had the Kaiser declare war, and the other nations were involved. Why? To carry out the Jewish plan. On February 8, 1920, Sir Winston Churchill expressed his alarm over world developments in an interview published in the Sunday Illustrated Herald, London. This is two paragraphs of quotes. From the days of Adam, Spartacus, Weishaupt, to those of Karl Marx, to those of Trotsky, Bella Kuhn, Rosa Luxemburg, and Emma Goldman, this worldwide conspiracy for the overthrow of civilization and for the reconstruction of society on the basis of arrested development, of envious malevolence, and impossible equality has been steadily growing. There is no need to exaggerate the part played in the creation of Bolshevism in the actual bringing about of the Russian Revolution by these international and, for the most part, atheistic Jews. It is certainly a very great one. It probably outweighs all others. With the notable exception of Lenin, the majority of the leading figures are Jews. Moreover, the principal inspiration and driving force comes from the Jewish leaders. Now, as it turned out, they didn't know at the time Lenin was a Jew, or half Jew. I think his mother was a Jew. Churchill referred, of course, to the overthrow of the Gentile state in Russia and its replacement by a hateful gang of homicidal maniacs whose unimaginable success was accomplished by the astute financial aid of Jacob Schiff to the Jewish revolutionaries and by Max Warburg in Germany, who at the crucial moment of the revolution in Russia arranged for Lenin to be transported through Germany to Russia in a sealed train to lead the conspirators to their Bolshevik triumph. Jacob Schiff, who was a Jew, whose money bankrolled the Jewish Bolsheviks, were also responsible for millions of Gentile deaths and the overthrow of the Russian nation. A statement of the situation from 1926 from a revised and re-edited version of A Sea of Blood, The Truth About Bolshevik Russia, a 12,000-word pamphlet originally published in Munich, 1926, and authored by a Russian émigré known as Dr. Gregor. It's his introduction. 9 years have been passed since an indescribable crime against humanity, the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917, was systematically begun. Now in its ninth year, which was 1926, a government exists which calls itself a worker and peasant government, but not one true worker or farmer has ever sat on it. For 9 years, torture has been used in the name of democracy as an official instrument of the state. And in the name of socialism, millions of upright individuals have been murdered, put to death through starvation, or banished from home and hearth to every distant part of the globe. In the name of the proletariat, the Russian people have been subjugated by rank foreigners. Their speech has been silenced and their bodies sent to the cheers of the Jewish Third International into mass graves. An old Russian expression says, "There are never more lies told than before a war and after a hunt." and in point of fact, the Great War, which means World War One, never had a true armistice. It never really ended. And the hunt for more human skulls, of course, only Gentile and Aryan skulls will do, continues in accordance with a sinister and systematic plan. And thus the great lie blooms forth, in effect, a form of a worship of the father of lies by the international scum calling itself the Bolsheviks. Mundus vult decipi. The world wants to be deceived. It believes Soviet lies and fairy tales, and even participates in this sick comedy, sending delegations of well-known people, leftists, of course, incapable of understanding the Russian language and sympathetic to boot with the goals of the Third International. The Third International was the third great convention meeting held by ultra-radical Jews and Marxists in 1919 to coordinate communist activities worldwide. Off these foreign guests to the Soviet Union to study the situation, the splendid chaps had no idea what Russia was like before the Bolsheviks and what it could have become without them in the meantime. On the other hand, the Soviets' new friends show great knowledge and appreciation for our Russian caviar and vodka. Their caviar is good. The vodka burns like fire going down, and in the brain fog of democratic good, will one somehow misses the rivers of blood, the dashed brain fragments, and the slithering clatter of millions of slaves' chains. And so international democracy, referring to Jewry here by the author, celebrates its rites of sacrifice. The gentle lamb is slaughtered. The systematic destruction of Russia. The old Russia no longer exists. In its place, we have a vast desert, its intelligentsia 90% annihilated, its middle class throttled, its working class made serfs once again, but this time serfs in state-owned factories, workers who, just for using the word strike, can be put up against the wall. As for the farmer, now he is a mere beast of burden, a camel in the Soviet-made Sahara, laboring without question for his Jewish exploiters and nearly without pay. For a non-initiate, it must be entirely incomprehensible how such a mighty empire, seemingly in one night of revolution, could be set aflame at all four corners and destroyed. However, in one night, it did not happen. The events of March 1917, Kerensky's middle-class overthrow of the Tsar, and on November 1917, the Bolshevik push against Kerensky's government, were only the visible result of years of patient, mole-like undermining activities by the Jewish Internationale, a work which did not begin in the criminal minds of Jews, Marx, Kautsky, and Engels, but instead in an early alliance of Jewry with the higher grades of the world, Jewish infiltrated Freemasonry. The author's note here is important to understand the Freemasons were infiltrated by the Jewish Illuminati in the 18th century and turned into an organ of global Jewry. And I'm going to read an article on that at some point, or rather do part of a show. Probably several articles or combinations thereof, or maybe some culling. Those lofty idealists have tortured and killed in the name of Russia's workers and peasants, and according to their very own statistics, the following numbers of victims in the first 4 years of the glorious Russian Revolution: 8,800 Gentile doctors and their aides. Why? Because they represented non-Jewish middle-class medicine. Now came the officers: 54,650 Army and Naval officers, 10,500 police officers, lieutenant rank and above, and 48,500 lower-ranking policemen. And for what reason? Because they were military and police officers, and we all know that militarism is no longer permissible for any nationalistic and Aryan-conscious white people. It is only allowed to red bandits who call themselves proletarians to dig the real proletariat mass grave. Let me relight this cigarette, hold on. Okay, then there are 260,000 flag-loyal soldiers of the old army, all now executed. But even this statistic is trifling. Now come the intelligentsia: teachers, professors, engineers, building contractors, writers, and judges, especially judges, because these were the most dangerous for a state ruled by convicted felons, to let us add lawyers, district attorneys, and all the college-educated occupations to reach the number of 361,825 murdered members of our most mentally demanding professions. I will not even tarry over our annihilated class of large landowners consisting of 12,950 persons. And when someone asks me how the Russian intelligentsia can bear the Bolshevik yoke, I always answer that the Russian intelligentsia is either literally 6 feet under or in exile, and that the tiny remainder left over has suffered such a bloodletting and systematic humiliation through the communist steamroller that they have forfeited every last bit of self-esteem and personal honor. Finally, we come to the modest numbers of workers and peasants executed by the worker and peasant state. They amount to only 192,350 workers and 815,000 peasants. All these figures are official statistics published by the Cheka, which was the forerunner of the KGB, and printed in easily obtainable Bolshevik papers during this period when the anti-communist white Russian forces fighting Trotsky in the Red Army from 1917 to 1921. All these facts can be verified in the complete volumes of information or excerpts published in 1922 by the Ministry of Internal Affairs of the Kingdom of Serbia, the only country in Europe who is fighting mercilessly against the disease of communism. Even this enormous number of casualties is small compared to the mentally ill persons now running around free in Soviet Russia. 4,800,000 of them. But this is no surprise. Even the old Russia did not have enough sanatoria and hospitals for them. Now the whole country has become a madhouse. The murders continue and the blood flows on, albeit only Gentile and Aryan blood. When during the 1922 famine, 30,000 human beings were dying every day, Jewish leader Trotsky made the sarcastic remark, "All the better. Look at the paperwork that will save us now." Czars assassinated by Jews. After Nicholas I, his son Alexander II mounted the throne, a true friend of his people. In 1861, he abolished serfdom and gave the peasants land. This reform happened through the MIR arrangement of village communities, an institution far closer to true and sincere communism than the capitalistic tax exploitative system we see in Soviet Russia today. This same Tsar, Alexander II, who in 1864 gave his people a whole new trial procedure for their court systems, then the fairest and most progressive in Europe, underwent 7 attempts to assassinate him until finally, in an 8th attempt perpetrated by Goldman, Lieberman, and Zuckerman, can anyone mistake their race, successfully carried out the wishes of London. Great Britain, by this time, was in the control of the Jewish bankers of the city of London. Alexander II, the great benefactor of his nation, was dynamited on March 1, 1881, the very day that he was to bestow on his country a new constitutional form of government. Alexander II was gone. Alexander III now became Tsar. With respect to this monarch who preserved European peace, we Russians were all convinced that when he died in 1894, he had succumbed to a normal illness, in this case an acute kidney infection. How great was afterward our amazement when we learned, on the run in exile and from Jewish sources, that this Tsar, too, had fallen victim to the criminal minds of the tribe of Judah. The Jew Saltus, S-A-L-T-U-S, exults over this fact in his book, The Imperial Orgy, published in New York, 1920. In his foam-mouthed delirium over the successful downfall of the Gentile Aryan world, he explains in his book how the Jews, working with the Entente powers, E-N-T-E-N-T-E powers, of England, France, the U.S., and Italy, got rid of the Tsars, one after the other. He further relates that at the same time as Russian churches were praying for the health of the Tsar, he was being cursed in the synagogues. The author's note, This is true and was proved in the 1911 case of the ritual murder of Andrei Yushchinsky, who was ritually murdered by the local Jewish community as part of a ritual by their own confessions to help bring down the Tsar in Russia to Jewry. Clear my throat. Okay. I don't know if I hit the right button on that. Okay. I didn't hit the right button, so you got to hear me cough. While the murder, which has been proven to have taken place inside the synagogue of a local Jewish-owned and operated brick factory, the jury could not determine for certain if it was Beilius, B-E-I-L-I-E-S-S, who had wielded the implement that punctured Andrei over 45 times, probably meant punctured, over 45 times around his body, killing him, drawing as much blood possible carefully from Andrei's body in the process. It was stated that the puncture marks done to the side of the child's head were done specifically for a special part of the ritual as a sacrifice so the Jews could overthrow the Tsar. To the bedside of the sick Tsar, his personal physician, Zakharin, Z-A-K-H-A-R-I-N, was summoned. Zakharin, a perfectly good Russian name and yet a Jew. When he arrived to see the Tsar in Levadia, he had the medicine all ready for him in his vest pocket. The king of medicine the kind of medicine is easy to imagine, a one-way ticket into the next world. After the trusting Tsar had swallowed the medications and was rolling in pain on his bed, Zakharin bent over him, according to Saltus, with a diabolical grin on his face. The Tsar choked out the words, "Who are you?" Zakharin's answer, "I am a Jew." And with enormous chutzpah, he then turned to the Empress and the Tsar's ministers and said, "Not to worry, His Majesty is only talking in a fever." Then he bent over the dying man and grinned at him again. "You are breathing your last breath, and we have won." That came straight from the Jew Saltus in his book, The Imperial Orgy. The murder of millions of Gentiles by the Cheka. And then when the Russian Revolution came, who were these friends of the common people who, in the name of freedom, equality, and democracy, began annihilating the Gentile Aryan population? Undoubtedly, there were among them some true idealists, useful idiots of Jewry, in other words, who really believed that they could use murder and manslaughter, robbery and theft, to make a happier world and a new paradise of equality. The well-known result was a living nightmare consisting of hunger, deprivation, despair, and inequality only in one's right to be murdered by the Jewish-controlled Cheka. The word Cheka is not only an acronym in Russian for Special Commission for Fighting Counter-Revolution, but also a Yiddish expression for animal slaughter. How fitting this expression. We Gentiles, who are called goyim, cattle, are in the Jewish view mere animals. Yahweh gave us human faces, however, so as to spare the Jews the distress of having servants who looked like animals. And that was paraphrased by the author. The first provincial government, after the abdication of the Tsar Nicholas II and just before the 1917 Bolshevik Revolution, consisted exclusively of corrupted Freemasons of Romance language initiation from France or Italy and funded by the Rothschild English money. The criminality of this provisional government knew no bounds because it did the most despicable thing a government can do. It ignored the promises, purposes, and ideas for which it was put in power and for which it had overthrown the Tsar head of state. The 9 months of this government was nothing but a gestation period, and horribly pregnant Russia gave birth to the miscarriage on October 27, 1917. It can rightly be said that power was lying there on the street, and the Bolsheviks merely picked it up. to provide a show for the friendly democracies abroad, there had to be street battles in Russia. And so the Prime Minister Kerensky, a half-Jew whose real name was Kirbis, K-I-R-B-I-S, meaning pumpkin, deliberately sent a battalion of women and young officer cadets into the jaws of a howling and murderous mob where they were sadistically annihilated. Meanwhile, Kerensky, dressed in a sailor suit, fled St. Petersburg. Just before that, Kerensky had signed, for publicity reasons, an arrest warrant against the traitor Trotsky, and his real name is Bronstein. But when General Polovtsev, showed up with his Cossacks in Trotsky's apartment to arrest him, there sitting in a plush armchair with Trotsky was Kerensky sipping a liqueur. He took the arrest warrant from the astonished general's hand, theatrically tore it up, and sent the general on his way. A man who lacked the courage to simply arrest both these scum for in a revolution, the first one to pick up his stick is on top. In any case, the Russian and foreign publics were to be treated to scenes of urban warfare and bloodshed. Aryan blood, of course. Let me take a sip of my drink here. Jew Lenin, a syphilitic psychopath. The Mensheviks, or majority people, wanted a peaceful socialist welfare state and limited state ownership of industries, as in Sweden. Let me clear my throat, sorry. Okay, I got the pause button right this time, or rather the mute button, rather. Okay. The Bolsheviks are minority people, mostly Jews, wanted a reign of terror and total nationalization under Lenin and Trotsky. The Mensheviks made only one condition, that Lenin explain himself with respect to allegations of theft from the party. When the convention began and Lenin was challenged to give an account of himself, he stood up, stuck his hands in his pockets, and proclaimed that his standing was so high in the party, he owed no one any answers. When Lenin first arrived in Russia from Germany, he was already demented from untreated or poorly treated syphilis. With this softening of the brain, a sort of gumming of the tissues, he was now fully qualified to pour his criminal fantasies into the ears of the foaming mob. Russia already stood in flames, and the shabby gang of brigades were encouraged by Lenin's slogan, "Rob back what they robbed from us." And so the mob hurled themselves upon the meager remains of Russian society under the joyful croakings of Jewry, Mother Russia was submerged. Truly, truly, the international proletariat can be proud. Its leader, a Jew thief, is prophetic, its prophet, a syphilitic, its greatest man, a mass murderer. Instead of leading mankind into the bright light above the clouds, it has jammed humanity down into the sewer, and it is no accident that his mausoleum, Lenin's tomb, looks like a public lavatory. Looks today like a public lavatory. After the February Revolution of 1917, Nicholas II abdicated his throne and took refuge with his family in a house in Yekaterinburg. The Tsar, his wife, his son, his four daughters, his servants, and family doctor were all killed in the same room by the Bolsheviks on the night of July 17, 1918. It has since been confirmed that Lenin ordered the clandestine killings from Moscow. Veteran British journalist Robert Wilton exclaims in his cult classic, "The Fall of the Romanovs, How the Murder of the Tsar and His Family Was Orchestrated Entirely by Jews." This is from the book by Robert Wilton. The whole record of Bolshevism in Russia is indelibly impressed with the stamp of an alien invasion. The murder of the Tsar, deliberately planned by the Jew Sverdlov and carried out by the Jews Goloshekin, Shromolotov, Safarov, Voykov, and Yarovsky, is the act not of the Russian people, but of this hostile invader. Trotsky, another killer of Gentiles. Lenin's great rival was a man who nearly exceeds him in treachery, viciousness, and sadistic love of executions. The Jew Leib Bronstein, L-A-I-B-E, who now calls himself Leo Trotsky, or Leon Trotsky. This Bronstein Trotsky character formerly was an ultra-radical writer of gall-dripping articles for Jewish newspapers, but long before the war, he was an agent of the Tsarist secret police in Vienna, reporting on Russian Jews who had deserted from the Russian armed forces. Trotsky, a full-blooded Jew, betrayed his racial brothers to the Russian government for 150 crown gold crowns a month, which is about $200. This perhaps tells us all we need to know about him. He moved to St. Petersburg and founded a very bourgeois and capitalist freight moving business. Later, he got into the business of lopping off heads when it came more advantageous to be a communist. The whole communist system under Soviet Judea is shot through with bizarre values, while pure communism is said to promise a community of sharing. The slogan of Russian communism seems to be, what's mine is mine, and what's yours is mine too. And this is a famous Trotsky quote, and this is from the memoirs of Aaron Simonovich, quoted in The Nature of Zionism by Vladimir Stepin, Moscow, 1993, translated from Russian into English by Clive Lindhurst. We must turn Russia into a desert populated by white Negroes upon whom we shall impose a tyranny such as the most terrible Eastern despots never dreamed of. The only difference is that this will be a left-wing tyranny, not a right-wing tyranny. Now, I know I read this, but I'm going to read it again because they inserted it. It will be a red tyranny and not a white one. We mean the word red literally because we shall shed such floods of blood as will make all the human losses suffered in the capitalist wars pale by comparison. The biggest bankers across the ocean will work in the closest possible contact with us. If we win the revolution, we shall establish the power of Zionism upon the wreckage of the revolution's funeral, and we shall become a power before which the whole world will sink to its knees. We shall show what real power is by means of terror and bloodbaths. We shall reduce the Russian intelligentsia to a state of complete stupefaction and idiocy and to an animal existence. They saw fit to reinsert that. Fiendish tortures devised by the Jewish Cheka. A whole shelf of books with both written and photographic documentation has been published on this theme. I need mention only the blood intoxication of the Bolsheviks by Nilostomsky, the battle against Bolshevism by Avilov, the plague over Russia by Albert Rosenberg, Soviet Russia by Katerina Hoghug, and the Cheka by George Popov. The author's note here, when Adolf Hitler was still a soldier in the German army, he was in one of the units that had brought to deal with Jewish communist insurgency in Germany. He personally, along with thousands of other German nationalist fighters, saw the remains of innocent Germans murdered the same way by the Jewish Bolsheviks in the city. He goes on to say here, again, the author's note, hundreds of reports and letters coming back from the East during the war from Axis troops and commanders mentioned fighting the same, the bodies of Gentile victims of similar atrocities killed by the Jewish NKVD in liberated cities, towns, and villages. This is what led to the pogroms, as hundreds of outraged Gentiles who had suffered for over a decade under the Jewish Red Terror machine took to the streets. to find these Jews within their kosher prized communities who had been their tormentors and murderers of their friends and family members for years. As the recent KGB reports also show, the majority of the Russians in the liberated Axis territory welcomed and worked with the Axis forces on every level, including I lost my spot here. Sorry about that. On every level, willingly, and thank them for liberating them for the Jewish terrorism. Let me reread that sentence so it makes some sense. As recent KGB reports also show, the majority of the Russians in the liberated Axis territory welcomed and worked with the Axis forces on every level, willingly, and thanked them for liberating them for the Jewish from the Jewish terrorism and oppression. Over a million also fought as volunteers for the Axis force to help liberate the rest of the Russians from communist Jewry. Most were later killed by the Jewish communist occupation state after the war. To the sum of millions, their crime was wanting to be free. Here now are some of the gruesome tortures devised by the Jewish Cheka for its mostly Russian Gentile victims. When the Reds occupied a city, they took hostages, such as people wearing ties or workers in their Sunday best. They stripped them naked and then bound unto the stomach of the murderer victim an empty flower pot into which a ravenous, starving rat was placed. Through the small water hole in the base of the flower pot, a red-hot iron rod was pushed to torment the rat and make him wild, causing him to try to burrow himself away from the rod and deep into the abdomen of the horrified human victim. They lined up other victims in military formation, then ordered the first row to place one hand upon a wooden table. A nail was driven through the hand into the wood. Then they cut a full circle around the wrist skin, drenched the hand in boiling water, and pulled the hand and finger skin right off. This they called making gloves. Interestingly, each torture chamber had its own special torture lady, always a Jewess or Jew-Latvian female, usually with a nickname such as Dora the Glove Maker or Rosa the Glove Lady. It comes as no surprise to us to learn that the Chief Justice of a criminal court in Moscow is also a Jewish, Anya Glusman, who is said to love pronouncing death sentences above all else, and according to a fawning newspaper article about her, she loves flowers and perfume after a hard day's work. There is more, such as placing a man's head on an anvil, then slowly exploding it using a huge iron hammer with ever-increasing weights. Those fated to suffer the same death the following day were ordered to pick up the brain and bone pieces, the nerve tissue and blood, which they witnessed flying around the room. When ordered to their work, they were told, "You are digging your own grave. You must be happy that tomorrow your own kind will be picking up the pieces of your cadavers." People had their eyes gouged out, the tongue severed, and the ears sliced off. Then they were buried alive, or their abdomen was opened with a knife, and the first section of their intestines was nailed to a telephone pole. They were then forced to run around the pole as their entrails unwound until death came. Officers of the Russian Navy were steamed to death in their own engine rooms. They were chained to cement blocks and hurled off the piers so that their tethered corpses, decomposing and rising under the waves, formed hideous, tossing forests of the dead. General Viren of Kronstadt had both his arms hacked off and then was paraded around the downtown area until it became boring, whereupon he was shot. Human beings had burning cigars pushed into their open eyes until they were blind, their entire body being roasted on spits. Heads were squeezed slowly to the bursting point with special brain vices. The German army discovered a chamber full of these and similar devices including a testicle cracker, in an underground chamber in Ukraine in 1941. Adapted dentist drills were used to drill deep into the brain. They sawed off the top of people's skulls and forced them to eat their brains, whereupon the eaters then came under the saw and in turn had their own brains eaten. Entire families were arrested and children tortured before the eyes of their bound parents, or the wife was tormented before the eyes of her husband, or the reverse. The Bolsheviks drove nails into empty wooden barrels, then jammed human beings inside, rolling the barrels around merrily. Mass graves of people buried alive were found by the White Army. Victims of live burial usually have dirt in their mouth and nostrils from trying to breathe. The writhing bodies of these people were found in the most bizarre contortions, and all this in the sweet name of freedom and democracy. Let me cough. An orgy of murder, extreme torture, and pillage. The orgy of murder, torture, and pillage was followed with the Jewish triumph in Russia, which followed the Jewish triumph in Russia, has never been equaled in the history of the world. For more than 1,000 years, the white Russians, descendants of German settlers in Russia, had provided an economic climate in which Russia, the breadbasket of Europe, had prospered. In a few days, this stable civilization vanished, perhaps never to return. The fortunate ones were those who recognized the peril in time to flee with nothing but their clothes on their backs. Those who dallied or sought to save others were shot down in mass executions, persisting through the night. The constant rattle of machine guns, muffled by the roar of truck engines, raced at full throttle to drown the sound of the shots and the screams of the dying. Had you experienced the high standard living in feudal Russia, perhaps you would have a different opinion of this alleged prosperity. The Tsar's exquisite daughters. At first, the daughters did not die because of the jewels sewn into their corsets. These jewels were for protection, but also so that the family could have some money for when they fled the country. The shooters were horrified at how the girls were able to withstand the bullets. To solve the problem, the shooters tried to stab them with their bayonets. That failed too because of the jewels, so then they were shot in the head at close range. The key word here is hatred. The Jews were free to indulge their most fervent fantasies of mass murder of helpless victims. Gentiles were dragged from their beds, tortured and killed. Some were actually sliced to pieces, bit by bit, while others were branded with hot irons, their eyes poked out to induce unbearable pain. Others were placed in boxes with only their heads, hands, and legs sticking out. Then hungry rats were placed in the boxes to gnaw upon the bodies. Some were nailed to the ceiling by their fingers or by their feet and left hanging until they died of exhaustion. Yakov, or Yankel, Mikhailovich Yurovsky, a Jew, is best known as the chief executioner of Russia's last emperor, Tsar Nicholas, and his family after the Russian Revolution of 1917. Others were chained to the floor, and hot lead poured into their mouths. Many were tied to horses and dragged through the streets of the city while the mob attacked them with rocks and kicked them to death. Mothers were taken to the public square and their babies snatched from their arms. A red terrorist would take a baby, hold it by the head downward. He would toss the baby into the air while another member of the mob rushed forward to catch it on the tip of his bayonet. Pregnant Gentile women were chained to trees and their babies cut out of their bodies. There were many places of public execution in Russia during the days of the revolution, one of which was described by the American Rohrbach Commission in the Fender magazine, October 1933. And this is what it said, a couple of paragraphs. We're nearing the end of the show. I'll read to a stopping point and then call it quits. hopefully I'm not reading in vain here, and the show is actually being recorded. The whole cement floor of the execution hall of the Jewish Cheka of Kiev was flooded with blood. It formed a level of several inches. It was a horrible mixture of blood, brains, and pieces of skull. All the walls were bespattered with blood. Pieces of brains of scalps were sticking to them. A gutter of 25 centimeters wide by 25 centimeters deep and about 10 meters long was along its length full to the top with blood. Some bodies were disemboweled. Others had limbs chopped off. Some were literally hacked to pieces. Some had their eyes pulled out of their head. Face and neck and trunk were covered with deep wounds. Further on, we found a corpse with a wedge driven into its chest. Some had no tongues. In a corner, we discovered a quantity of dismembered arms and legs belonging to nobodies that we could locate. That, I think, ended that. What was from that publication. The Jewish Communist Czechs took pleasure in brutally torturing their victims. Victims were nailed to trees, had their eyes gouged out, noses cut off, ears removed, tongues removed. There were Jewish Czechists who cut open their victim's stomach, pulled out a length of small intestine, nailed it to a telegraph pole, and with a whip forced the victim to run circles around the pole until the whole intestine became raveled. Eyes of Gentiles' victims were poked out, their tongues cut off, and they were buried alive. A major Gentile member of the Voronezh, Voronezh area, was boiled alive in a big pot, after which others of the community, revolvers at their heads, were ordered to drink. The Kharkov people were scalped, and Taristasin and Commission people's hands were amputated with a saw. In Poltava and the Kremchuk, the victims were impaled. In Odessa, they were roasted alive in ovens or ripped to pieces. In Kiev, victims were placed in coffins with decomposing bodies and buried alive. I'll read a little bit more and then I'll get to a stopping point. On March 13, 1917, Jacob Schiff sent Mila Yukov, new Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Bolshevik Revolution government, and a personal friend of Schiff, a telegram produced in the New York Times, dated April 10, 1917. I'm going to read this and then call it quits. Allow me, as the irreconcilable enemy of the tyrannical autocratic government, which pitilessly persecuted our co-religionaries, referring to the Jews, to congratulate, through your intermission, the Russian people for what they have so brilliantly accomplished, and to wish success to your comrades in government and to yourself. Okay, now, do I need to ask the question, what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants? I'm going to close out with some final thoughts. I think we have the answer about what happens if we don't prevail over these tyrants. Truth does not fear investigation. Belief is when someone else does the thinking. The truth is hate only to those who hate the truth. A noble society is not ruled by might, but by law. Preserving your culture isn't hate. It's about survival. You do not have the right to never be offended. The fact that they want our guns is all the more reason to have them. There are no illegal guns, only illegal gun laws. Anti-gun is anti-white. Anti-Semitism is a disease. You catch it from Jews. Free men aren't equal, and equal men aren't free. Distinct peoples have a right to remain distinct. Multiracialism is not self-government. Forced association isn't freedom. If you worship your enemy, you are defeated. If you adopt your enemy's religion, you are enslaved. If you breed with your enemy, you are destroyed. Ridicule is the only weapon which can be used against unintelligible propositions. There is no higher religion than truth. Religion leads to racial death. Racial death is forever. 1488. So until next time, hell, Satan. And I'm going to play a song to go out with here. And this will be a short one.
Never know.